Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. Well, thanks for joining me again here in the Storycraft Cafe. I am your host, Hank Garner, and today I am super excited to have Janice Hallett on the show with me. She has an amazing new book, and it is called The Mysterious Case of the Alperton Angels. Janice, I absolutely love this book. Mystery is probably my favorite genre. I love to read all over the place, but you know, I'll take some time and catch up on science fiction or fantasy or whatever, and I always find myself coming back to mystery, thriller, cozy-ish mysteries are kind of my absolute. It's just where I default to, and there's probably a lot of reasons for that. My mother was a huge mystery fan, and you know, by osmosis, you know, these things come into your life, whatever. But I absolutely love it, and this book is the form that you use to tell the story, and we're going to get into all this so the listeners will know what we talk about, is a little shocking in the beginning, and I mean that in a very good way, where you're kind of taken off balance but you want to dig in to find out what's going on and where are you taking us. The book is amazing. It comes out in the US on Tuesday, in just a couple of days from now, already out in the UK. This is a book you must have. Janice, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Hank. Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be on here and talking about mysteries, because I'm like you. I'm a sucker for a mystery. If there's no solution to something, I really want to find it.
Right. Before we start digging into all of that, I like to start the show with a fun question. And a question that I love to ask people is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or a storyteller?
I can tell you that. It was when I was 6 years old, and I just learned how words were put together, how each word is a combination of syllables, basically. So you can look at words in how they're constructed. And I realized that words were how I was going to communicate with the world. The written word was going to be my interface with the world, because I was a very shy child and I didn't like talking, but I did love writing. And discovering that secret to put in words and sentences together, that was it. I knew writing would be my thing.
That's a pretty heady concept for a six-year-old.
It is a bit. I think I didn't have a very detailed concept of how I was going to be that particular writer. But yeah, from that moment, I was hooked really on the creativity of sort of creating my own words and worlds. Like you can create anything with words. It's like painting pictures.
Absolutely. Did there come a time where you taking this love of language and then trying to figure out how publishing worked and how I'll just tell you my experience as a kid. I remember going into the library or a bookstore maybe and just seeing all of these books and not having any concept of what it took to create the story that then, you know, went to a publisher and went through a series of editors and, you know, all of that to then the process of printing and binding and then distributing and then, you know, it winds up on a shelf at the bookseller. And, you know, that it was you go from just thinking these things are kind of ethereal and they just exist to, okay, now there's not only a person behind the writing of the story, but there's probably a whole band of people who have been involved in the process along the way of getting this thing, you know, to now on the shelf where I can, you know, pick it off. And I remember kind of that concept dawning on me. And if someone could have written this and these people have been involved in the process, then all of a sudden that's something that you can do. You know, if someone else can do it, then, you know, the bar may be set high, but it's, you know, it can be traversed. Did you have a kind of a moment of awakening like that?
I guess I did, because as a child and a young person, I loved Enid Blyton, but I knew that I loved her books. I never connected her to a person. I mean, luckily, right. So she was long passed away by the time I was reading her. Sure. But it was only when I was sort of much older that I started realizing that whole thing you were talking about, that this is a process that you can go on now, that publishing is a journey. But I have to say, for many, many years, I felt that journey and that process was fairly closed to me, that I wouldn't be able to get through those gatekeepers and through those thresholds that I'd need to get through to be a published author myself. And it was why I think my career has taken quite a meandering journey to get here. I've done other things instead. I've been a journalist. I've written plays for an amateur drama company. I've written speeches for a communications company. And it was after doing almost everything else that I managed to get here, that I had the confidence to write a novel and have it, or try to have it published, to cross that threshold of belief in oneself. So yeah, that was a gradual awakening on my part, I think, over my life.
Well, let's talk about that meandering journey, as you said it, just a little bit, because we've done more than 1,500 author interviews over the last decade, and you hear all sorts of stories. Everyone has their own journey. Out of those 1,500 or so, there's maybe a single handful of people that I've met whose singular focus was writing and publishing, and that they're, you know, that's the only thing they ever pursued. They started writing, you know, in middle grade in school, and, you know, as soon as they went to college or university, they studied, you know, getting a creative writing degree, and then, you know, that's the only thing they ever pursued. But that's a single handful. Everybody else, the other 1,495 people, have sort of a circuitous route. They, you know, they go and they pick up some experience here, and they gain some tools for their writer toolbox over here, and, you know, and all of those things kind of stack up until, you know, you become the person that you are. Looking back over your journey to where you are now, can you pick out any certain things that just kind of stick up higher that you have added to your writer toolkit, that you're grateful for those experiences now?
Oh my goodness, everything. Do you know, every step on my journey has been a step up that mountain. And it's not only gaining writing experience, I think, it's also gaining life experience, because a novel is not just the 90,000 words. It's all of those 10, 20, 30, 40 years that you've spent building up your life experience and your insight into sort of the human condition and into the lives we live that have all gone into that book. So yeah, it's lots and lots of things, but there's been an awful lot of writing I've done that has helped me now. And I think starting, having the confidence to start something, that's a really big hurdle. And I think working on magazines and newspaper articles really helped me there, because you have to start. If you don't start, you don't finish it. And if you don't finish it, you never work again. So that, that driver is a really good leveler. And it gets you to overcome a lot of your blocks for yeah. writing. So I'm very grateful for that, for meeting deadlines as well. That's another skill. For finishing your work, these are all separate skills that you need to build up and develop. I also did playwriting and screenwriting, and those are quite, in different ways, quite brutal in terms of the feedback you get. So, for example, yeah. if you write a play and your amateur drama group stages it, as mine did, the audience might not like it. They might not laugh in the right places. They might not, it might not hit. So you have to have the confidence and the ability to say, yeah, right, it might not work, but I'm going to do it anyway, and gain the experience from it, which is what I did. You know, I wrote and put plays on, and not all the jokes garnered laughs, not every plot twist worked. But, you know, I learned so much from each one to take forward. And screenwriting, getting feedback and notes from other professionals about your work, and letting go of the need to have your way and to be precious about things, to see things from other people's point of view and see that there is another way of doing things. That's another strength when it comes to novel writing, because your editor and the other people around you will have suggestions as to how to improve your novel, and it helps if you're open to them. That will give you a better work in the end. So all of that has come together and helped me in my current job. So yeah, I think publishing is a journey, but also your life as a writer is a journey. And
right.
with every different piece of writing you do and different genre that you venture into, you'll improve and build on your skills. So yeah, it's, I think the word journey in this context should have a capital J.
Right. I find it fascinating that you were a playwright. I've known a couple of stand-up comedians that I was really fascinated by that art form in this way. When you're a novelist, you spend, you know, a year maybe working on a manuscript, and you get it to a point, and then you send it to an editor, and you get this editor's feedback, and it's usually always that I've experienced a back and forth as you go through this editing process until you kind of, you know, shape this thing into what it will be. A stand-up comic writes out this routine and then performs it in front of a group of people, and they get kind of immediate editor feedback, if you will. And like you said, are they laughing in the right place? Are they, you know, is this plot twist working? You can see it on your audience's faces, you know, and as a playwright, you get, you know, near, and I know there's a lot of preparation, and then you put it before an audience, but you're getting feedback from a whole audience, not one single editor or a panel of editors, you know, depending on how your publishing house works. That had to be tremendous feedback, you know, getting this reaction, a visceral reaction from a group of people that, you know, you would think that writing a novel and going before one editor has got to be, and as terrifying as that can be, it's got to be better than a room full of people.
Oh, that must be a baptism of fire, isn't it? Being a stand-up right. comedian. That's an extreme form of it writing is. And performing. It really is. And people who can do it, oh, my goodness. And that,
yeah,
they're very strong characters who really put themselves out there. I think we could probably learn from that as writers. Writers are traditionally very shy and introverted. Yeah. You know, people who don't want to put themselves out there. But yeah, I've forgotten your original question because I'm thinking about the terror of being a stand-up comedian. Of being a playwright. Yeah. It's sort of similar, because I remember that moment when in my first ever play, there was a joke, say 2 minutes in. And I knew that if they laughed at that joke, if the audience laughed at it, they were getting the story, because they wouldn't laugh if they didn't get the story up to that point. Sure. And they did. And that moment they laughed, I've been trying to recapture that feeling ever since. It was like an addiction. There was something about it that was so wonderful. And I really wanted that again. So, yeah, it's brilliant. And I think when comedians talk about being addicted to the audience laughter, yeah. I really get that. It's a kick that you get out of that.
Yeah. So from journalism to screenwriting and playwriting, what was the catalyst to make you attack this form?
A strange story, because I've been screenwriting.
I love a strange story.
I've been screenwriting for a while. I'd written a film, a low budget British psychological thriller called Retreat. It starred Cillian Murphy, Tandy Wayne Newton, and Jamie Bell. And we'd had that made. I'd co-written it with its director, Carl Tibbetts. And we very luckily, you know, saw that film on the big screen. It was wonderful. And I had continued screenwriting from then on, trying to get into TV. Now, the years had ticked by and I wasn't getting anywhere. And they were, you know, 10 years went past and I still wasn't anywhere. So you can imagine, I was quite downcast about that. And I was recommended to try novel writing as a means to getting my ideas on the screen. Because I was given a mentor in a gentleman called Cameron Roach, who at the time was assistant head of drama at Sky Television. And he said, yeah, this, you know, TV execs look to novels for their next TV hit. So, you know, if you write your idea as a novel, that you could help to get your idea out there that way. And that's really what led to me turning my attention to novel writing. And I took the idea that I was working on for my next spec script and turned that into The Appeal, my first novel. And that's why The Appeal is quite unusually formatted. I didn't look into how to write a novel at all. I just closed down my final draft document, opened up a Word document, and thought, well, this is a story about a couple who joins a local drama group. Right. So how about I have the emails that are flying back and forth between the minor characters as the main thrust of this novel? And I was off. That's what I started doing. It was letters, it was emails, some texts, and, you know, I didn't look up for another year. Like you said, it took me a year to write that first draft. And, well, the rest is history, because that was my first novel and it was hugely successful. I'm very grateful for. But I came to it in a very roundabout kind of way. And I came to it by doing something different. I've been doing the same thing for years. I've been writing spec scripts and submitting them and expecting to get a different result. But I wasn't, but I was still writing another script. So the minute I changed and did something different, that was when my fate changed. So that old adage is quite true. If you're stuck doing the same thing, switch it up, try something new.
Love it. The final novel, was the story essentially the same as it was with the, you know, in the script form that you had written?
I hadn't come to a conclusion for it in the script, but it was certainly the same setup. It was a couple who'd been volunteering as medics overseas. They come back to the UK and try and settle in by joining a drama group. And the situation in that drama group, they see through slightly different eyes because of their experiences overseas. So they arrive in this very small world. And we have to ask ourselves, really, are they seeing it as it is, or are they just simply seeing it through different eyes, seeing something which is okay, but they're interpreting it differently because of their experiences? That was essentially the same. I think the novel goes further and it expands that idea out. As novels tend to have rather more story than scripts do. I did have to expand that story to make a novel.
You have room to let some of these concepts kind of breathe and see what, you know, how these things might play out if you have the time to train a camera on this situation and just kind of see what unfolds. And you have that luxury in a novel where you don't, when you're working on a script that has to come in at 90 minutes or, you know, whatever the form is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, a novel is a great opportunity, particularly to delve into character. I think you can really get to grips with a character in a novel, whereas on screen or even on stage, character has to come across very quickly and very snappily, usually through dialogue. And with a novel, you can let that breathe and you can let characters develop rather more slowly.
It's a very interesting choice that you made with the appeal to have it be a series of communications between these characters, and it becomes an epistolatory story, as we would say, an epistolary story.
I think it's epistolary. I never really know how to say that word.
I love, they both sound amazing. So, we'll just throw them about. But you said that you just, I'll just have it this way, that, and that's kind of become a hallmark for your writing, is this sort of style. And I absolutely love it. And that's what I alluded to in the very beginning when I said that the story is a little, off-putting is not the right word, but it kind of takes you off balance in the beginning, because you immediately kind of fall into these characters' conversations and you're like, what is going on? You're almost like overhearing a conversation that you're not supposed to be listening to. And so in one sense, you want to turn away because I'm not supposed to be here, but I kind of want to know what's happening here. there's this human tendency to want to, overhear something you're not supposed to overhear. So you get a little bit of that, going on in the beginning. And then before you know it, you're just completely sucked in. And, there's been a trend for, I don't know, the last decade or so, really since Gone Girl really kind of exploded on the scene, of this unreliable narrator kind of trope that's made its way into mysteries or thrillers or, whatever subgenre you're talking about. But in this form that you take, is it an unreliable narrator, or is this just people's perceptions? And that may be a slight distinction, but I think it's an important distinction, because is this person deliberately trying to throw the reader off, or is this just the way they see the world? And if that's the case, that there are many more implications that can happen, because if you've got a character who truly believes this and is not being manipulative or whatever, that's a whole different thing.
Exactly. I mean, we all have our own reality and our own truth. And when you're looking at all the different characters, they could each be telling the truth as far as they see it. Right. But it might not, none of them may know the exact truth. So yeah, that's the delicious thing about the way my novels are structured, that you see everything from a first person. All the characters give you their personal point of view. So as the reader, you're always with them. You're always in their shoes. And I write in that particular way. I tend to jump into each character. I think of it a little bit like an actor jumping into character. And I do that with my characters, so we get that first person. And I think might be interesting to show you the journey of my three novels, how this one is a kind of, to use that word journey again with a capital J, it really is a journey. So the appeal was a set with lots of characters, and it was told through emails largely. Mm-hmm. The Twyford Code, my second novel, was one character's story, single character, and because he can't read or write, he dictates his investigation into his childhood events, and what we're reading is an automatic transcription of what he spoke into his phone. Now, my third novel is a mix of those two things. It's a mix of emails, WhatsApps, texts, it's transcriptions, interview transcriptions, because it tells the tale of two journalists who are writing books. So they interview people and those are transcribed. So we get in lots of witness accounts in it. We get notes, scripts, extracts from novels that are pertinent to this particular case. So it's a whole mishmash of information that is presented in a particular way that leads us through the story, through an original cold case, and through the current investigation into it. So I think what I've done is learn a lot from those first two novels to create this one. And it was, that was almost deliberate, because my first two novels were written before I was a published author. Even The Twyford Code was written by the time The Appeal came out. And this is the first novel I wrote knowing what people thought of my writing and knowing what they enjoyed about it. And of course, I was writing something totally different. So that could kind of set me worrying at 3 a.m. When I heard what people liked about the first two that weren't in this one. But anyway, it is all part of the journey. And I think this book in particular, the reader is an investigator. They are immersed in the story, and they're carried along with each character as they're discovering what happened either to themselves or to others in the past. And that's kind of what I like about this style of writing, that you get that first person journey the whole time.
Absolutely. In the writing community, we love to put people firmly into one of two camps. Either you are a pantser, or you write by the seat of your pants, or you are a meticulous plotter and you work out all of the ups and downs, twists and turns of a book beforehand, so that then you write, you know, by a roadmap, if you will. Do you fall firmly into one of those two camps, or are you like most people that I've discovered and you kind of got a foot in either place?
I fall firmly into one camp, and that's the pantser. I actively don't like plotting anything in advance of that first draft, because I like to set off and with a vague idea of what, you know, the world I want to write in, sometimes a vague idea of the characters I want, but I like to let them emerge in front of me as I write and draw me through the story. That's for me is the joy of writing. I hope that's what comes through as people read, that wonderful feeling of creativity as I was writing that first draft. Because I do have to say, when I get to the end of that first draft, I'm left with quite a mess. I've started 3 or 4 different novels in there. I've got stuff that doesn't work. I've got things I have to put in to work with the ending I discovered I was going to have. I enjoy that first draft, and then the hard work starts of going back, and I plot it in reverse. It's reverse engineered, the whole plotting thing. But it's the characters, I think, that I like to develop as I go along. And then I go back and retrofit a plot that has emerged while I've been writing. So, yeah, I'm a pantser. And I'm kind of jealous of the plotters, because I think, well, if I was a plotter, I wouldn't have that hard work after the first draft. But the grass is always greener, and I'm sure the plotter thinks, always, you know, thinks the same of the pantser. But yeah, no, I really respect plotters and people who use spreadsheets to work out their plot. I don't regard that with disdain at all, because that's a great way to do it, but it's not my way of working.
Sure. Your new book, The Mysterious Case of the Alperton Angels, there are some big idea concepts in this book. You've got true crime. You've got a cult. You've got, disappearing people. You've got kind of these big tent poles of story. Did you, and you said that you love character, you love exploring these people. Did the big concept ideas come first, or did these characters come and then you figure out what to drop them into?
I can certainly tell you what was in my head as I started that first draft. In my head was the fact my first novel had been a huge ensemble cast. The second novel had been one character, and I really wanted a double act for this novel, and particularly a male-female double act. And indeed, you know, I have got that. I've got two true crime authors who are at loggerheads about their research. So that's what I wanted, a double act at the center of the story. I knew I wanted something based around true crime, because that's a genre I love, and yet I have an equal discomfort with my own enthusiasm for it, because it's gaining entertainment from other people's you know, worst experiences. And that's not lost on me, despite my love for the genre. So that dilemma, I wanted to explore that, to pick that out and explore it in a book. And I also love the, I love cult theory. It fascinates me why people start cults, why they, how they come to join them and how they come to stay in them, which is often a something's quite separate to why they joined. So that really fascinates me. So all this came together in the story, and leading me through it is Amanda and Oliver, the two journalists who are researching an 18-year-old sort of cold case, really. They're going back. They're trying to find a person who was involved in a cult mass suicide 18 years ago, because that person was a baby. They were almost sacrificed by this cult who thought they were the Antichrist. But luckily, the teenage parents of this baby escaped. And now Amanda and Oliver want to find that now 18-year-old who can tell their story for the first time. So that's quite a scoop. So they're looking back at this case to try and find out where this baby and the teenage parents went to try and find out exactly what happened from their point of view. But in doing so, they uncover all sorts of things that other people want to stay hidden. And because what everybody thinks they know about that cult, it's not quite the case. And Amanda and Oliver, blunder into some quite interesting territory in their investigation.
Yes, they do. Let's talk for just a minute, Janice, about genre and subgenre. It seems to be that over the last decade or two, there are such specific genre and subgenre designations for things. And I understand the need for that. You know, when a person walks into a bookstore and they're a huge mystery fan, or maybe they're an epic fantasy fan, they need to know where to go in the store to go find the book they're looking for. I understand that. But as a writer, most writers that I've ever met, pull influences from all over the place. And a lot of times the story that they are writing doesn't necessarily fall easily into one bucket or another. Your books have a lot of elements of a very old genre, but a fairly new designation, I think, of cozy mystery. There's a lot of characters that are kind of quirky and a lot of snappy dialogue and a lot of fun settings. But then there's also some subject matter to your books that is very dark, and a mass suicide cult, and human sacrifice. That's pretty intense, subject matter there. Do you think about these things when you're writing, and does it ever come into your mind, I should or should not put this in because it may be off-putting to a particular kind of reader, or to a certain segment of publishing? And we can talk about the publishing process in a minute, but in the writing, do you think about how this will be received by a group of people or not?
Occasionally I do. And certainly in terms of how graphic I write things, I'm not keen on being too graphic personally. It's not something I like to read. And on the other hand, it doesn't fit with my style of writing. I'm not a horror writer. I'm not that kind of crime writer. So I do pay some attention to how I portray the crimes. It doesn't stop me dealing with those sorts of subjects. As you say, that this book is probably my darkest, and it does look at cults and this mass suicide that took place years ago. So I don't shy away from, the gritty stuff. It's just how it's presented. And I think that's true of quite a lot of crime fiction, that we don't go too far into the emotions of what we're writing about, because we're rather like police detectives. I mean, police detectives want to find the serial killer. They want to find the murderer, but they can't let their emotions the victims take right. stop them from solving that crime. They have to put their emotions aside in order to concentrate on the clues, the evidence, and solve the puzzle. Now, that's what I think a lot of crime fiction readers do. They don't want the deep emotions. They don't want the reality shied away from, but they want to solve the mystery. So I take that angle when I'm writing. I think, what do I need to solve the mystery? What do we need to know? We don't need to know any more than that. We don't need huge descriptions of what's happening. I'm aware of that. I have to say, though, I'm quite surprised to find my novels described as cozy crime, yes. which is quite a wide definition of, includes things like Agatha Christie, and it can also include things like Killing Eve, which is a form of cozy crime that shies away from emotions, but totally different to what I would write. I would say calling what I write cozy crime is fine, but it doesn't take into account that darkness that I don't shy away from including, along with a lot of other people in the cozy crime genre. We are also quite realists in terms of what we write.
And people that have not picked the book up yet may hear us talking about this darkness and think that the book has this certain tone all the way through, and it absolutely does not, because you balance that darkness with a snarkiness, with a lightheartedness. And I've always said that there's something about adding levity to your storytelling that not only helps to kind of lift the that wet blanket from the story of just this oppression, but it also I think if done correctly, adding moments of levity throughout the book not only helps to, keep the reader's emotions in check, but it also makes the darkness that much more dark. Because if you, and this is probably not a good example, but I'm thinking of writers like Stephen King, who maybe there's just a lot of darkness in the book, and as a reader, you can only handle so much, but if you let the reader off the hook a little bit and let their emotions rise back up and let them laugh a little bit, then when those moments of darkness come, they almost hit harder. And, there's more emotional impact. Do you think about things like that when you're writing? Like, okay, this has been dark. Let's let the reader laugh a little bit.
I certainly do. I tend to do that more when I look back on the story to balance it, get that light and dark right as you're going through, get the tone correct, because that's so important to have a sort of cohesion of tone throughout a novel. And you're absolutely right. I mean, to balance the darkness of the Alberton Angel story, I use the lightness that you often find among people who work in dark areas, police officers, journalists, people who have a kind of gallows humour about what they do. And this comes out in my book with the character of Ellie, who is Amanda's assistant, and she transcribes all her interviews. And I don't know if anyone listening to this has ever transcribed anything in the course of their job. It's quite a boring thing. However interesting what you're transcribing is, it's pretty dull to do that job. So Ellie lightens the job for herself by putting comments in. They could be comments about the interviewee. They could be comments about Amanda and her style, or what she's asking, or admonishing her for lie into the interviewee about recording or not what they're saying. Ellie is like this every person. She's with us as the reader, reading what Amanda's writing. The character of Ellie for me was really important in this book. And I have to say, she evolved. She was never meant to be a big character when I first put her little comments in between the transcriptions. I thought that would be all she did. But as the book goes on, she has a more a larger and more important role to play as this character looking in on the action. And so she became far more. And I think that's the joy of being a pantser and to allow that journey to unfold. I got this light character suddenly started to really balance out the darkness, and she became very, very important to the story.
Did it evolve in the sense that the story opened up to a place where Ellie's character was needed, or did you kind of fall in love with writing that voice, so you started looking for places where she could grow and shine a little more?
I found she inserted herself quite naturally into the narrative. She is thus that kind of character, just as she will. Her brackets and her initials do signal something in the text. When we read it, something is being said here. And so, she evolved of her own accord, as some characters do. They're very, very strong. And while Amanda is one type of strong character, I think Ellie is another type of strong character in a novel. The two of them really balance each other. Amanda is balanced by Oliver on one side and Ellie on the other. And you could see them perhaps as good angels and bad angels, to use the angel theme of the book. So they become quite a trio, quite a triple act by the end of the novel.
I love that. The Mysterious Case of the Alperton Angels releases here in the States this coming Tuesday. You can pre-order it now. It's been out in the UK for a year now. Does that mean that you have a new release coming out there in the UK pretty soon?
I had the Christmas appeal out just before Christmas, both US and UK.
Which is a follow-up to the appeal, is it?
It is. It's a novella. It was a Christmas, a Christmas novella. So a short book, a fab, fun and festive read, I would say. And it's a 1.5 it's appeal 1.5, as a lot of people were describing it, which I love, because it is a very small, very fun read for Christmas. And it looks at the world of the appeal 4 years after the events of the first book. Completely standalone story. You don't have to have read the appeal. But a murder happens while the drama group is putting on a pantomime.
Of course it does.
And that balances the darkness of the Alperton Angels for sure. But no, my next full-length novel is, to best of my knowledge, it's going to be out in the US and the UK at the same time. So that will be The Examiner, and it will be out in September of this year.
Okay.
So not too long to wait. I think, to the best of my memory, it was COVID that stopped my novels being out at the same time, each side of the other. So we've taken this long to manage to sort of catch up with each other. But luckily we will. Come September, that will be it.
Ah, great. Well, Janice, you're spoiling us with wonderful content that's coming out. The Mysterious Case of the Alperton Angels. If you're in the UK, go to your bookstore and grab it now. If you're here in the US, wait until Tuesday or pre-order it from Amazon. We'll put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you to find it. Janice, if people are just discovering you and want to dig into your back catalog and, experience all these stories and then maybe want to find out more about what you're up to, is there a place where they can follow along online to, look for new news and anything coming up from you?
Absolutely. I'm on X at Janice Hallett. That's two L's, two T's. And on Instagram at Janice.Hallett. So between those two platforms, you'll find out everything I'm doing, often on a day-to-day basis, because I'm on those two apps far more than I should be when I should be writing. those two places for up-to-the-minute news.
Excellent. We'll link those up to make it easier for folks to find you as well. The Mysterious Case of the Alperton Angels. Go grab it today. You will not be disappointed. Janice, this has been so much fun chatting. Thank you for taking time to join us today.
Oh, thank you very much, Hank. It's been a delight. And thank you very much to everyone for joining us.
That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk to authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing. Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool should not be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.